Welcome to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm Curator of Education. Glad to have you here tonight. Most of you know that Tuesday Evenings is a weekly lecture series. Next week, even though it's spring break, we are going to have a makeup date for last Tuesday's cancellation due to inclement weather. Sorry. thank you. Artist Misty Kessler and Allison Smith, who are both represented in the Modern's recently opened Framing Desire, which I hope most of you have had the opportunity to see, will be here in conversation with the curator of the exhibition, Andrea Carnes. So I hope you come back next week, and I encourage you to bring a friend. Tonight we are happy to welcome New York-based artist Jonathan Shipper. I know that many of you are big fans of Jonathan's work and have followed his career to date. For those of you who are new to the work, I think you're in for a real treat, an opportunity to revisit the value and intrigue of making in art, and then to give some thought to the inevitable entropy that happens after the making that follows. Jonathan Shipper was born in Chico, California. He has a BFA from San Francisco Art Institute and earned an MFA from the Reinhardt School of Sculpture in Baltimore in 1998 with an MICA fellowship from 1996 to 98. From early on, even as an undergrad, Jonathan received recognition for his ambitious ideas and well-honed skills with a number of fellowships and awards. In 2001, he received a fellowship from the Skowhegan School of Painting and Sculpture. He has since exhibited widely in the U.S. and internationally, and just to name a few of the exhibitions in recent years, Jonathan was included in last year's State of the Art, a large survey of national trends at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas. And in 2003, there was the 20th anniversary exhibition of Pierogi Gallery, where Jonathan is represented in Brooklyn, as well as his solo exhibition that year, Detris, at Pierogi's large annex space, the Boiler Room. His work was chosen for the 2012 Guangzhou Triennial. And in 2011, he was included in Art of Deceleration at the Kunstmuseum in Wolfsburg, Germany. Also under construction, a traveling exhibition that originated at Museum Tongli in Basel, Switzerland. And the solo exhibition, Autobody, that some of you may have had the opportunity to see or know about from Ballroom Texas in Marfa, Texas. I mean, Ballroom Marfa in Marfa, Texas. My apologies. Of course, there is more, but for the sake of time, I will conclude with Jonathan's exhibition that we in Fort Worth are anxiously anticipating, which opens March 28th at Fort Worth Contemporary Arts of TCU. And tonight, of course, we are here for insights from the artist himself. So please join me in showing appreciation for Jonathan Shipper's willingness to share his work and ideas with us tonight.
Thank you very much for coming. Let me start the timer so I can... Okay, so this goes back about 15, 18 years ago. So this piece is three people hanging from a gantry crane, and the switch you see out in the front, that switch there, allows you to basically shake any one of the people in the machine that you choose. So what this came from was I grew up on a ranch in California, and let me look at another slide. This is it in motion. You can see people moving back and forth. So in the ranch, cattle had a very different relationship to objects than we usually do. Yeah, lots of apparatus to manipulate the cattle, to castrate, to doctor, to whatever it might be. And I was always interested in those apparatuses growing up and what they, how they had no relationship to whatever a cow's ego might or might not be. and thought a lot about how ultimately we share so much in common with cattle in terms of our physical makeup. We're, you know, made of muscle and bone, but all the objects we relate to, you know, if it's a car, it's a Porsche or a Chevrolet, they're all made to relate to our egos first and to our bodies second, well, or in conjunction with our egos, appeal to our egos. So this piece was really about trying to underline the physicality and the commonality that we have with those animals. Not really trying to say it's good or bad, not really interested in that in general, but just that there is this commonality, that we are ultimately flesh and bone, and you know, we go through life and it's so hard to really, our whole minds are made to, you know, think other things. You know, we're made to think, you know, I'm a scholar, I'm a, you know, musician, I'm a whatever, but you're still an object, you're flesh and bone, like the cattle, like the sheep or the dog or all the other mammals that share the planet with us. So this was my way of sort of bringing people into that space. And it was interesting. This is something I did to others and myself at the same time. And it seems very aggressive, and in a way, I suppose it is. But the experience of being in it is actually kind of just the opposite, since all your power is removed, like you're just hanging there as if you're a thing. And you don't have the ability to interact with anybody, to say no or yes or any of those things that we do all day long. So it was really kind of this, I don't know the right word, but it really felt empowering in a strange way, because you sit there and all the rest of the world is taken away from you. And, you know, you relate to it in a totally different way. You have the vision of the floor beneath you and things like that. So it was really kind of the opposite of what it might seem, being in it. And the aggressiveness of Sor, of course, is part of the piece, but, you know, ultimately it's interesting how it switches when you're in it. Now, this piece came about 5 years later, maybe, I'm guessing, but this is a similar piece, and what you're looking at is it in construction. This isn't the final piece. So on the way it worked is people could get into either side, and let me skip over this for a second. We'll come back to that. And this is somebody in it, and each person had a controller that would control the other person. So they couldn't see them. They couldn't, because you're facing the opposite way. But you could manipulate them. So you could hit a button and something would happen to them. But since they were connected, whatever you did to them happened to you in some way. And some of, you didn't have power over the buttons in that you didn't know what they did. They just had four big buttons and you hit them. And sometimes it would do things like both people would rotate, and then sometimes it would just flip the other person upside down. And then the things we skipped over. These are two masks worn by musical component of the piece. So I was interested in, these are all things ultimately that are about my childhood, growing up, cattle, the manipulation, and then the state fair where you had people with rock and roll coming in, and you had amusement rides, and you always had some strung out guy playing, you know, his AC/DC too loud while kids were throwing up on the whatever apparatus they were being thrown around on. And so I wanted to have a musical component, and but I wanted it to, I always liked the, well, what I did to the poor performers was they sang inside these helmets. There were two of them, and everything that they were playing was electrical instruments. So without amplification, there was really not a lot of sound, basically quiet. It was a room full of lots of people, and they would play, but they could hear themselves because it was all going through amplification system. And then they would when the machine would go on, it would all get turned on, and everybody else would hear what they were playing. So it was this, you know, idea about live versus recorded. And throughout my work, I've always been interested in how, you know, we're an increasingly mediated society. You know, everything we do is, you know, taken. We take pictures of everything that we do, and we relate to everything through all these photographs and media endlessly. And but it's never, you know, being a sculptor and being three-dimensional, there's always things that I felt are left out. So I think that component was, you know, playing on that idea of live versus media, and, you know, it being a sculpture and a performance, but then trying to turn that performance on its head and be like a recording, and that it can just be turned on and off and manipulated in, you know, kind of an awkward way. This is a drawing of its construction. So at this point was my first sort of introduction into, I do a lot of 3D modeling and manipulation and drawings to make these objects. They become increasingly complex. And this is sort of an early drawing of that complexity. So, like, I was interested in, you know, how this computer could just turn the, you know, these are basically the same drawing drawn on itself again and again and again, and how that three-dimensional world and time and everything can combine into a drawing that that has a history of the making and the thinking and the three-dimensionality, and, you know, ultimately this is just a two-dimensional drawing. All right, so this is a piece shortly after that. This is called Fuck Me Now or Leave Me Forever. And also goes back to two different memories of my childhood. This was made with Amelia Biewald as a collaborator. She did the, I'm going to use that spiffy laser again. She did this part. And I did the mechanism. And so what it comes from is two memories, and they're both in actuality slightly wrong. But I grew up in the mountainside, and we'd see these birds fly up super high, and then they would kind of tumble out of the air and then separate at the right before they, you know, hit the ground. And it's this badly remembered but actually remembered version of the mating. So they do this ritual where they fly together, and they kind of, you know, you don't really know what they're doing, but they tumble and then they separate and they just keep doing it. And I remember it from my childhood. And then the Fuck Me Now or Leave Me Forever is from Top Gun, also from my childhood, very formative movie. And so, is the button not working? There we go. That's a little closer view of it. So the way it worked, we don't have a video of it tonight, but they would move up to the top of the thing, come together, kind of manipulate themselves on the way down, and then come apart, and they would cycle again and again. This is skipping to a few years later. This is a construction photo of 215 points of view or invisible sphere. So again, this is another piece about media and about how we see things and don't see things. And so there's this idea in media that it gets you to the other end, that you watch a war video and you know what's going on in Afghanistan. And you watch, you know, whatever video of something else, and you know what happened. But I've always been struck at how that's not actually true. I mean, I'm sure many of you have been in actual events that have been recorded and put on the news, and just the amount of errors in a simple event are amazing. And so this isn't about the documentation in terms of what happened, but the visual documentation. So what it is in physicality is 215 monitors and 215 cameras. And so it has two different ideas. One is that it's an invisible sphere, and obviously it's the opposite of invisible in every way. You know, it's this big, monstrous tube. You know, it's over a ton in weight. And it doesn't disappear at all. It calls total attention to itself. And so it's sort of poking fun at the idea that media can be invisible, because it's not. You know, the whatever angle the photographer takes is a choice that influences how you take information back out of that media. And this sphere, the other thing that I find really interesting is that if you look at it, and it's hard to convey in photographs, but you can sort of see here how each view is completely opposite, is completely different from the one next to it. And they're all in the same space, same lighting conditions, same environment, but it's just completely different. We have a video here coming up. Is it going? There we go. Okay. So it's also movable. So originally the idea was that it would roll around in a space and you know, find new new points of view. But it ended up weighing so much that fear of squishing some small person ended up nixing that idea. Well, we have hung it a few times, so then you can move it around, and it's really nice when it moves around. But yeah, going back to this idea, you can see like some of the screens interrelate, and others of them just, you know, all of a sudden you're looking at some mouse in the corner or some lint ball that is totally invisible or unnoticeable in a normal room. So again, you know, about media and about how media affects everything that we're dealing with. This is another piece that I made with Amelia. It's called Firebird, and also relates to nature and man's influence on nature. So it's a engine out of a 1960-something, I should know, but I don't, 69, you can quote me, Firebird. And then I like the idea that, you know, these cars are named after things that they're not, you know? Like, they're not birds. They're kind of the opposite of birds. And, you know, there's big, heavy pieces of metal. And so I thought, well, what if this car really wanted to be a bird and wanted to be a tree and wanted to relate to nature? And so this is this awkward representation of what that transformation might be. And so Amelia did all the more organic parts, and I did the more structural parts, and we collaborated on the idea. So it's, you know, this obnoxious, you know, giant, you know, exhaust, you know, nasty big engine. And it works, so you can turn it on in a gallery. It was a lot of fun to turn it on in a gallery. We had the exhaust. We had to run it outside the gallery exhaust building, and we would turn it on. Water would condense in the pipes, and some poor person would get water sprayed on them, and the gallery would stink for an hour. But it was a lot of fun. And I'm also interested in where sculpture sort of combines with this muscle car aesthetic. You'll see it again. I'm not really well liked by the muscle cars guys, but I actually have a lot of love for them. You know, it's in America, if you're a guy and you feel like art is a bad word, which I feel like a lot of people do for whatever reasons, cars and the aesthetics in cars are, you know, a place where you can let out those aesthetic ideas and, you know, talk about line and color and still feel, you know, whatever. That's, but anyways, I'm interested in where those things overlap with the art world. And this piece, you know, is a muscle car engine and, you know, painted in, you can't see it in the photos, but this fancy pearlescent white paint that's quite beautiful. And here he's watering the tree / car engine, whatever. All right, so this is a shift here a little bit. These are two classical sculptures that I purchased online. So they, and then built a mechanism around them. So this is a mechanism that hangs up in the air, and then you can see how they fit together. And what happens is the mechanism slowly rubs these objects together and slowly erodes them. And thinking about a few different things, one is just the how relationships, this is the same piece, essentially, just a bigger version, so I'll keep talking. How relationships change each other, you know, for good or bad. Everything we meet has an influence on us and changes us. And also really interested in the fundamental idea of what art is and what creativity is. In that, in order to make anything, you have to sort of destroy something else. The easiest example is if you make a tree, you destroy a table. I mean, I'm sorry. If you make a table, you destroy a tree. Sorry. Said that too many times. Maybe we could just. Anyways. You know, you're always changing something else. So this act of creativity, this, you know, beautiful, idealized act, is also an act of destruction. It's an act of changing, you know. And and also I've been interested in this idea that this fundamental idea of art, that you take an idea, you put it into an object, you place that object somewhere, other people can come to that object and extract that idea out by looking at it. And how, you know, it's fundamentally has issues in that people change, the objects change, everything's always in motion. You know, our ideas of what the object is, the society around the object is always in flux. So that ideal is never really, really met. In that, you know, you see a Motherwell 20 years ago, you see a different thing than you see the Motherwell now, even if it's been perfectly, you know, contained and hasn't changed, which isn't a reality either. You know, everything changes. I was looking at Marfa, we were looking at the Judd's hallway of boxes, and we noticed that every box was no longer in line. And it was just from the heating and cooling of those boxes, they had slowly walked on their own. So, you know, I'm sure Judd is turning in his grave that they're no longer lined up and symmetrical in the way he meant. But the world's always in flux, no matter how hard we try not to. And then this piece, I think, ultimately is embracing that. You know, I think it's beautiful, and I think that creativity is about change and about the balance in between destruction and creation in a way that, you know, creates something new and for the future and, you know, takes from the past. So, you know, that's also about these sculptures and that they're, you know, art history. They're bad. They're just bought bad reproductions. But, you know, the idea is that art takes from the past, destroys it, and creates something new. And that's what it should do. And destruction is part of life and, you know, needs to be embraced and needs to be, you know, and not wholly, nothing can be wholly embraced, but, you know, needs to be respected. And this one here is the same piece, but kind of the orgy version. So it's called Sexy, Shameful, Naked, Nude, which came from the eBay title of one of these sculptures. So I just thought it was so perfect. Let's see. Go get it. So this is a close-up of it. You can kind of see what they're made out of. Just these. I love the idea of these classical reproductions that aren't either. You know, they're made in China and they're brand new and they reproduce an idea that you know has been exchanged so many times that who knows what the original idea was anymore, but I have a lot of affection for him. So this is a piece in the same idea. This poor guy was made out of plaster in the bottom and cut him into pieces and started just adding simple kind of animatronic appendages to him. I did a lot of work prior to this for Jim Henson and places like that, doing this kind of thing for the Muppets and things like this. But I thought it'd be interesting if classical, you know, this idea of this classical sculpture was combined with Slayer. And so Slayer's a thrash metal band. I said in an interview that they were a death metal band, and 10,000 15-year-old boys told me how dumb I was. Anyways, thrash metal band. So I converted Slayer's music to player piano reel, which I'm pretty sure I have the only copy of Raining Blood on player piano reel, and then made a self-made apparatus to turn the notes into motion. So play here. I think that's up there. Yeah, okay. So So what it does is each note gets turned into a movement and read by, you know, a series of light sensors. And, I just think it was fun in this piece to try to combine these things that have nothing to do with each other, but ultimately